All right, I've got the great Jean Marie Jobs on the show. She is a coach, speaker, author, and much more. Jean, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here, Joel.
Yeah, me too. You know, we had mutual friends that connected us and said, you got to talk to this person because she's doing some disruptive things in the coaching industry that not a lot of people are. And you know me, I love disruptive people.
Yep.
And I got a chance to take a peek into your background and just all the thing that you've done and really leadership and working with teams and organizations cross-culturally all over like the continents of the globe and doing some work with first responders. And so I can't wait to dive into things and all that you know very, very well. I'm curious though, before we even jump into that, those tactical things, like how did you get started in this work of just, you know, life coaching in a sense, or just the coaching world, but even like leadership, like what made it so important to you that you felt people aren't getting it and I'm going to do something about it?
Yeah, thanks. I had this really powerful experience in 1996, if we're going to rewind the tape, and I was in the middle of a transformational training. I was participating, and there was this moment in the training where all of a sudden it came so clear to me that I had spent the predominant amount of my life holding myself back, mitigating, wanting to make sure everybody was okay, fixing things, and that is not what I was created for. I got this really clear sense, like, hey, you're created to be out there, to be poured out, to be living fully alive, and you're playing this really small game. And it was simultaneously really convicting, but also a call forward where I just was like, okay, that's it. We're done. And my friends, they know I love taking action. So I'm like, okay, now what? Let's move. Let's go. And it just began a whole process of really immersing myself in transformational work, in training, in coaching, in the principles, and the excitement of what it means for someone to be able to create their own life, to reinvent their life, to pivot, to have something new that they never thought was possible before. And that began a really long journey that I'm still on. And I feel so privileged because I've gotten to take it into a lot of really creative, unusual places and spaces in my life.
Yeah, I mean, in your background, I mean, you've worked with like Disney and some of these top corporations. I mean, you don't get to work with these really big organizations by accident, you know? So it's really, you know, your work is a testament of what the results that you've gotten people, let's just put it that way. So yeah, it's really, really cool. On that note of transformation, and you had your own block that obviously you had the aha, that's what it is. And I know now I need to start doing that for others. What was that block that you see that is in a lot of us that's getting in the way from reaching our transformation, our highest version of who we are?
Yeah, I think for me, it was definitely a familial, historical conversation based on growing up and being in an environment where there was some violence and some abuse, and also feeling like as the oldest child, I needed to take care of everyone and everything, and that vulnerability was weakness. There was like a lot of meaning that I gave my life. And hey, it worked because I survived my childhood. You know, I'm high-fiving myself right now. Yeah. High-five to all of you out there. And recognizing that those exact same beliefs and strategies that really helped me navigate uncertainty when I was 9 were still at play when I'm 29 or 39. And they're no longer as useful. They don't work as well. They're not going to take me where I want to go. And I think for all of us, we have certain assumptions, and it's all of our assumptions are based on the past, and that's not bad or wrong. They've absolutely served a purpose. They may just be beyond the purpose now. Like that purpose is gone. Now you have a new purpose, and the beliefs and the stories aren't serving where you're headed. And so that exploration and that, let's not judge it. We don't have to be wrong and bad. And now what? Like, what would be something new that I can create in my life moving forward? Who do I get to be in this new scenario?
Yeah. Wow. Love that. I want to get into like some of the tactical things that you see from the leadership world and just, and I mean, all your traveling and throughout the world. But before I do, I'm just thinking, and I had a problem even introducing, I said, how do I introduce you? Because you just have done so much and you have such an eclectic background. But if someone's just tuning in and they're listening, like, what's your superpower? Like, who do you typically work with if you're just trying to give an idea of like the work that you've done and what you currently are doing?
Yeah, I work with a lot of executives, a lot of people that are looking to move the needle into someplace they've never been. And I think in that way, I'm like a hope dealer. So I'm dealing out the possibility of what you've decided is not possible, or maybe the things that you've settled for. And I'm looking for areas of resignation. I'm looking for areas of cynicism, and because those are usually, they're rich with also the flip side of that, right? The possibility, the longing, the depth that we cover over with resignation or cynicism, because that's painful to long for something or hope for something that we don't know if we can have it happen. So playing in that field, that's what I'm passionate about. I'm loving working with different people in their, just in their own belief systems around who they are and what's possible and what's not possible.
Wow. That's messy. That's
messy. So messy. It's so unpredictable.
You know, it's funny because I've been reading Joe Dispenza's work. I'm very familiar with it. I just finally sat down and started reading his book, Becoming Supernatural. And he talks about going into the unknown. Yeah. And that all of us, when we try to manifest something, it's typically from this place of the past because our brain understands that. But when you really want to 10X your life, you want to be disruptive, you want to change the world, you want to do the work that you're working with these global leaders, you've got to go into the unknown. That's the only way. But it's scary because we don't know it.
It is. And it's also, it involves, like, I have to stop believing myself in some way, believing what I've been telling myself. I have to hold that lightly to embrace something new, and also recognize that I'm making up stories all the time, and nothing I've decided is any more true than something I will decide in the future. So why not give your energy to something that's possible? I remember several years ago, this is probably 20 years ago, I had a good friend who invited me to come speak at an event, and it was in Toronto. I fly to Toronto, I get to the event, it's the day before, and we go look at the venue, and this is, I didn't ask a lot of questions at this time, okay? Learning number one. And I get there and it's this huge, huge venue, probably 1,000 people there, big Jumbotron screens. And I start feeling like, oh, shoot, what did I sign up for? I can't do this. Who do I think I am? And I start spinning a little bit and looking around. I get back to my hotel room and I'm like, oh, I think I'm getting a sore throat. I don't know if I can talk tomorrow. And I'm hearing myself and I'm, Jean, you're not going to cancel on your friend the night before. That's not happening. Why are you freaking out? I start listing, well, the venue's really big and there's a lot of people and I've never done it before. And so I said, okay, great. Well, who thrives in these venues? Like, look at the venue. What do you think of? I'm like, rock stars. This is a rock star venue where you're on this, you know, double Jumbotron world with the big stage. And so I started saying to myself, well, that's because you're a rock star. You're going to do this because you're a rock star. And this is what rock stars do. They show up on the big stage and they make it happen. And I realized in that moment that believing I was a rock star and giving energy to that story was no more true or false than I'm getting a sore throat and I don't know if I can do it. So,
wow.
I thought, hey, if you're going to make stuff up anyway, make up something that moves you towards your vision.
Yeah, no, and that's really interesting because you just created a new paradigm for yourself. You created a new identity and you just took that on.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking too, like the polarities, right?
Yes.
Like in one polarity, you're in fear, but guess what the opposite of fear is in the polarity world?
Yep.
Faith. So you just changed it. You just, it just, it happens that quickly. You just changed it.
Yes.
Okay. On that note, because, you know, you talk about this in your book, The Art of Feeding Heroes, right? And you talk about delve into this concept of leading from within, right? Mm-hmm. And in today's era, we have, image crafting. I'm curious, how can leaders maintain their authenticity? And like, in what you just spoke about, like, how do we maintain that authenticity and show up who we are? We're not faking it till we make it.
Yeah, I think that is such a great question. Part of it is you do the things that you're asking other people to do. You go first. Mm-hmm. And the humility to also want to know when you're out of integrity, to invite people to speak up and to create a culture where there is, you can feed back up, down, sideways in the organization, because it's just data, it's just neutral. And recognizing that if I'm not hearing any feedback, then I have zero possibility of course correction. And if I can't course correct, I will never get to my vision. And so I think it's that willingness to be clear about your direction and also flexible and adaptable in maybe how you get there, and hearing who you are showing up for with other people, how you're showing up. It might be different than the way you think. So is that okay with you? Are you okay being surprised or feeling like, oh, maybe I'm being misunderstood, or maybe not. Maybe you're not aware of your impact and it's an opportunity for you to pay attention.
Wow. Like being present too, right? Being present.
Being present. Yeah, that is the discipline.
Yeah. Listen, you've worked though with some, and I talked about it, you've worked with some really prominent organizations, Disney, Microsoft, and you've helped them in change management in these transitional periods. What have you noticed in terms of just, are there common pitfalls that a lot of leaders encounter during this transition?
Yeah, and it changes. Is such an interesting topic because on one hand, it is a constant, right? We all know that. We all know change is constant. On the other hand, we all resist it. We, as human beings, we're biologically wired for and addicted to certainty and predictability. Nothing wrong with it. It's just going to be there. And what I've noticed working with people as they go into a change situation, whether it's a merger or they're adopting a new CRM or really whatever it is, there are some really specific pitfalls, usually starting with communication. Because often your C-suite will know about the change months, years even, before everyone else. And so what is now seemingly normal to them is brand new information to somebody down the line by the time it gets out. So there's an element of, are we communicating generously? How are we patient with people's process because they're jumping into something that now I've already reconciled? I think the other piece that I learned from reading some of William Bridges' work on change management is there's a difference between change and transition. And what oftentimes people get stuck in is that experience of transition, because the transition involves loss. And sometimes as a leader, we're thinking of all of the benefits of this change and we're excited about the change. And not necessarily recognizing or calibrating to the rest of the team who might be experiencing loss, whether it's loss of position, loss of, oh, I had access to you and now I don't, loss of the way I've done things, loss of my sense of, I know how to do the thing I'm doing and I'm doing it well. And so now you're going to change it. And what if I can't be right anymore? That's very scary, right? And so I think there's an element of grieving, frankly, that is part of any type of change management and any type of transition. And then typically there's a lot of attention paid to the structure of the change, but not necessarily the contextual work of the change and people being aligned and what they're believing and really what their private conversations are versus they're just giving us the party line. Getting underneath the surface to the conversations that are really driving people's behavior is a unique talent. Most people haven't had a lot of experience in doing it, don't know how to do it. It feels messy. It gets frustrating. there's a lot. So I think it's an exciting place, though, to walk with someone in a coaching or training space to illuminate many of those conversations so that they can be addressed.
Yeah. Wow. Some big things just came up for me when you were talking about that. Well, number one, though, is I always have this like idea, like if you're working at Microsoft or you're working at Disney, like you're at the highest of high, like you've gotten there because of your skill set, right?
Sure.
Can't you handle this? Like, what do they need someone like Jean Marie Jobs to come in and like change them? But what I always come back to is like, we're human, and as highly elevated as I think I am, I have bad days too. And so, I'm just curious though, like when you're working with these CEOs and high executives, I'm sure they come in like, just like I'm just saying, like know it all. Like, yeah, Jean Marie, I know all this stuff. Like, I know you're going to tell me positive mindset and do this and that. How do you break down though some of these guys, because they have their blind spots and they're not seeing it. They need someone like you to kind of, I don't want to say rattle them, but maybe break three so they can see those blind spots and they can show up and be a better leader for their company, their culture, their team, their family, everybody.
Yeah, I think that's where the art of disruption comes in. And at some level, the invitation I make is, hey, whatever that's not working, tell me how you've contributed to that. Tell me what your part is in that, or tell me how long has it been going on. So so clearly you like it at some level, because like I remember I was meeting with a first time potential client, and they were telling me about their organization, and they, you know, I'm like, well, what are you looking at? What is it? What needle are you hoping to move? And he said, well, marketing and sales, they don't talk. They're constantly at each other's throats. Marketing puts stuff out there, and then they say sales makes stuff up and sells things that they haven't created yet. You know, the usual. I'm like, yeah, that's their job. But so I said, well, how long has this been going on? And he said, about 7 years. And I said, oh, great. So tell me why you like it. And he was like, I don't like it. That's why you're here. I was like, okay, and at some level, we're complicit in the things we tolerate, right? So at some level, you're getting a payoff for it. There are benefits to it in some ways, maybe invisible, maybe visible, but let's see if we can illuminate those, because if we just start moving the chess pieces around, it's like, you know, changing around the furniture on the Titanic. It's still heading towards the iceberg. Where's the rudder? And the rudder is the belief system. It's where, what are the private conversations? What are the things in the blind spots, maybe unaware or aware, that people are getting out of the situation they're in such that the situation continues? So this is how the world occurs to them, and they have a choice on that occurrence.
That is so good. When you said that, it just brought up my own journey and my own marriage. And, yeah. I've shared with you and a lot of the audience of just how I turned it around quickly, but how I was complicit for 10 years, not showing up, not being the leader that my family was calling me to be. Yeah. And I didn't even see it. I had no idea. I was complicit in it, and I was accepting the status quo. And I think a lot of us get in that way in our marriage and our business and everything. We just accept it as is. And we actually believe the paradigm is, oh, it just has to be this way. Like, it is that way. And I'm going to fall into rhythm of that acceptance. But that's not okay.
It is. It's like, this is all there is. Or this is it, also, this is just how they are. Or this is just how I am. So you can hear usually in people's conversations where the blind spots tend to live. Well, this is just how it is. This is just how I am. This is just how they are. This is just how our industry is. And we recognize that anyone that's ever created something incredible has not done things the way that they've always been done. That's the whole point. And what does it look like to recreate or reinvent that personally or in your family or in your team?
Yeah. Also, I had David Siegel on the podcast a while back, and he is the founder of meetup.com, or he was he actually came in, they brought him in. He wasn't the immediate founder, but they brought him in to take over, and the company was just dying. And he looked at the books and everything. He goes, you guys are just bleeding money. He goes, I gotta fire a lot of people, and we gotta start making money. And people did not like it because, like you said, there was loss. And I never thought about that in these transitions. When we're transitioning through things, we think, oh, this is a part, I'm going to lose something. I'm going to lose a part of me. Mm-hmm. And so is there a way that an organization or that you can help founders or these executives or the culture in general see that, hey, it's actually not a, it is, it might be a loss, but it's actually a gain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's both. It's the opportunity to let people express their experience of loss. Like, we're not going to demonize it. We're not going to judge it. Let's be honest about it. And also, can we hold that, and can we hold the new thing that's going to be amazing at the same time, and be patient with people as they process, because people process at different rates. And if I move fast all the time, that's just my natural rate of motion. Some people move way more methodically, and they catch details that I miss for sure, i.e. my husband. But, yeah. You know, and that's, I think as leaders, we tend to think people should just process the way we process because this is how people need to do it. And that adaptability piece, like, how can I flex myself to meet people where they're at and recognize that unless I want to hire a team of clones, I need to be open and generating that type of diversity on my team, even like how people think and how they process. And maybe someone's going to take longer to grieve. That's okay. How do we make that okay and create a space where that belongs sitting next to, and we're excited about where we're headed?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I was just thinking too, is there anything in your professional experience where you've worked some with somebody, maybe who was even difficult, right, as a leader in the company? And of course, we're not going to share names, but just maybe it took them a little bit longer to get this concept or get this new idea. Maybe there was a lot of resistance.
Yeah. And
was there any like unconventional like piece of leadership wisdom that you gave them that unlocked things for them that you can recall?
You know, I remember I was working with a Fortune 500 company, and we typically, before I'll go in and do some training, I like to do some pre-interviews. I like to talk to everybody and just hear, what are some of the conversations that are happening in the culture? What are things that are okay to talk about? What are things that are not okay to talk about? I want to get a sense of what I'm walking into, so I'm not blindsided, but also so the client isn't blindsided. And so I'll listen and, you know, tell me about leadership, tell me about feedback in your culture, tell me about accountability. And I'll put together a report that doesn't have people's names, but it has some of the highlights of, hey, here thematically, this is what I've heard. This is what's going on under the surface, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I submit it to this director of marketing, sales. And we get on the phone, we're reviewing the report, and he just loses it. And he is yelling at me on the phone. He's like, I don't know where you got this BS. Nobody thinks this. This is, you know, da da da. You made this up. You're trying to like get it, make sure you have work. And he just went off. And I'm just listening. And I go, see what's happening right now? That's what your people are experiencing. This. And to his credit, he was like, whoa. Like, it stopped him because he wasn't aware that his explosivity, the close-mindedness, that things are this way and they're not some other way, and I don't want to see the things I don't want to see, like that attitude was creating an environment where people were walking on eggshells. And when that happens, you miss all the ground truth, because no one's going to be that person to bring it to you as a leader, because you're going to explode. And no, most people aren't going to risk being exploded on. Like, yeah, there are people that will take that risk, but predominantly no one wants that. They just are like, fine, I'm going to go get my paycheck and leave. And then you get employee disengagement, you get the cynicism, you get the resignation, which impacts everything, because the way people spend their energy, their internal conversation energy, has everything to do with the impact on the bottom line.
So true. You're nailing it. I want to divert slightly here, because I want to, you have a background in, you know, in law enforcement and being a police chaplain, which is a really you know, my background being a police officer for over almost 15 years in two very busy cities, Oakland and San Francisco.
Wow.
And police chaplains, they don't get paid. They are doing this out of the goodness of their heart, and they're very special people in the peer support community. But, you know, I know you've done that, and you've done some work as a cognitive coach with the Six Foundation, which is also an organization that delves towards first responders and veterans and healing them. I have a bone to pick with the first responder world, and I'm really thinking about the leaders in the first responder world. Okay. And I'm thinking about law enforcement in particular, because that's where I was at.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of leaders not leading. I see them go to their little leadership retreats, and then they come back for a week, but then they go right back into their old little ways. And I remember specifically Simon Sinek, one of the profound leadership, leaders out there, came and spoke to the San Francisco Police Department, and somebody asked him a question, and they said, Simon, like, how do we like relate to our people? Like these plebeian officers at the lower threshold, right? But like, how do we get to them? And he looked at everybody in the audience just like in astonishment. He's like, guys, it's so simple. You talk to them. He's like, instead of being in your ivory towers, how often do you come down and actually talk to the people and say, hey, Joel, can I just have a walk with you as we go walk your foot beat? And can I just ask you, like, how's your family? I know you have two kids. Like, tell me about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that blew my mind, that advice. And I was just blown away. And he nailed it. He nailed it so hard, because right now I see really this heart mind kind of disconnect in leadership in many of the roles, and not one single leader in that room did he actually go out and do the things Simon said, which again, we know this stuff. How do you see that as well? I'm just using leadership in the law enforcement world, but how often do you see that just in general? And just, there is no human connection, I feel like.
Yeah, I think when I'm working with law enforcement, veterans, part of the navigation is you absolutely must compartmentalize at some level to do your job.
Yeah.
That's, you are trained to do that. So there's nothing wrong with that. It's not that you can do it. It's that you don't know you're still doing it. Right? And so I think part of it, at least in my work, has been like, listen, your hypervigilance, your attention to detail, your compartmentalization is an incredible strength at times in these scenarios where there's an emergency or a crisis. And what would it look like for you to, we don't have to kill it. We don't want to kill it. How can we take the dial? Like, how can we dial it down?
Yeah.
And so that, number one, your body has a chance to relax, and you can connect with people, because also that's another part of leadership and life is connecting with people. And my experience in chaplaining is oftentimes at a crime scene, a death, that police officers that I talked to, they are very empathetic. They want to be there and talk to the people and help, but they've got to process a scene, or they've got to interview this guy over here. And so I could see that in them. Most people join the force, whether it's veterans or law enforcement, that because they have a care about their fellow human beings, you know?
Yeah.
And they're like, we can't do that right now. We have to do this other thing. We're really glad you're here to do the thing you're doing, which really most of the time just involved listening and just listening and being with people and killing the urge to want to fix things. And I think, you know, learning from 15 years of law enforcement, would say that's top learning, is how do you just be present?
Wow.
Be present with someone. There's nothing to fix. You're just present with them. And the presence itself actually achieves the thing that you're wanting to achieve. And you just don't see it. You may not notice it.
I love that. There is nothing to fix.
No.
There is nothing that Joel's sour because he's being forced to work on multiple days, or they didn't get the pay raise they were supposed to get in the latest contract. Yeah. You don't need to fix anything for me. I just want you to talk to me, Chief. captain. Yeah. That's all I want. I just want to be heard. I just want to be seen. I want to be present. And I'd never thought about this until you brought it up. Our job, we are hardwired to not feel anything. Like survival, I need to actually get through this scene and process it. Otherwise, I might die. And so it's actually a very good skill for me to have. I always joke that it's not a good skill when I come back to my family or my marriage. But now that you just brought up a good point, I never thought about that in terms of the echelon of leadership. Mm-hmm. As these guys or women are climbing through the ranks, they've built this hardwired response that I don't feel anything. So even at the top, I'm numb. Yeah. How can I form human connection and be present with you, Joel? I've never mastered it from the beginning when I was an officer to now a chief.
Yeah, because I don't see the resource in it. Right? It doesn't show up on my radar like a possibility, like a choice. It shows up like a threat. And how do I then become present so I can pay attention to context? Because it's no strategy works in every context. There are strategies that work in different contexts, but if I'm not paying attention to the context, I'm just using the same thing over and over. It's, you know, the proverbial, the only tool I have is a hammer and everything's a nail, because I know this works. And then I stop paying attention. So many times when I'm talking to law enforcement or veterans, it's because there's something going on physically in their body. There's something in their marriage, or they have one event that then everything stops. And it's almost like there's a train going down the track and it finally hits a wall. And then all the other cars go, into the front engine. And that's how it is. You get to the straw that breaks the camel's back event, and then everything piles on. And there's been many times I'm sitting talking to someone and I say, hey, tell me what's going on. And they go, in 1977, I had this one case, and it's like a horrific story. And like, wow, who did you talk to about that? Who did you process that with? Who did you debrief with? And it was like, well, yeah, we talked. I'm like, what do you mean? Who did you talk to? We talked about it. I was like, I'm not talking about sarcasm and beer. I'm like, and they're like, oh, no, we didn't talk about it. Like, it's okay. Like, you know, we have these coping mechanisms, whether it's the dark humor, sarcasm, whatever. They work. They're a little tiny Band-Aid, but they're not going to solve whatever else is going on, and it's just going to build up. And I think that's true really in any space. Obviously, it's really clear in law enforcement or with veterans because everything is heightened. It's equally true with your regular C-suite.
Interesting. Yeah. Talk about just a little bit, because we're on this framework of law enforcement. Talk about just some of the work that the Six does that people may not be aware of. And, you know, I'm just thinking too, as you're talking, I was just thinking like how powerful this work is, and just being present and being connected, because we're so disconnected. And me, myself, you know, my story, I was in an officer involved shooting my first year and a half out as an Oakland police officer. And at the time, mental health, Oakland was like, oh, they thought they were the best. They were ahead of the curve. They made me go sit down with a shrink before I went back to duty. Well, I just went and saw this shrink like a week after the shooting, and he said I was good. And he just asked me some basic things. How are you doing? I'm like, great. I feel fine. I mean, you know, I'm feeling good. And he goes, great. Stamps me off like, you're good to go. I went back, and for about 6 months, my hand would shake anytime I would stop somebody and I would do a car stop, and it would hit. I could not write down someone's information. Wow. And then as a broken officer, in Oakland, I would never tell someone that this was happening to me, because I was a year and a half on, 27 years old. And that meant I was broken. I wasn't going to tell anybody that. So I went out and I tried to even make more stops to prove to myself that I had this and I was in control. And it took a while, and it just all of a sudden went away. I didn't have the language to even say, oh, is this PTSD? Nobody talked to me about that. I just assumed it was, I knew there was something going on, but I didn't want to care enough to even ask questions, tell my girlfriend, who's now my wife. I hid that from everybody.
Right. It also in that scenario, you interpreted that there was something wrong with you, that you were broken, when the reality is you were having a very normal response to an abnormal situation. Your body was doing the thing it's wired to do.
No, you nailed it. But I didn't know. And at the time, I didn't have the language. Yeah. And nobody ever said, like, hey, nobody checked in on me. There were no other additional resources 6 months later. Like, hey, how you doing, bud? Like, it was like, oh, like in Oakland, shootings happen. And that's what happened. And for my shooting, it was even worse because I didn't fire. I was my partner fired. So then I felt like guilt, like maybe I wasn't, maybe I didn't respond correctly, even though people said you did. So there was all this guilt and shame, probably. Oakland is a very, I don't want to say macho area, but it's just, you got to be tough to work there. It's one of the top five most dangerous cities in the United States. And not the average. Let's just put it this way. There's officers that can go work in other cities that would never make it in Oakland. So there is a different breed of people that work there. So I think I had all of these stories playing out and I didn't know who to talk to, what the resources were. And I think what you guys are doing at the Six is to alleviate some of that and find solutions for veterans and first responders like myself who didn't know where to go. Is that right?
Yeah. And we do a lot of different modalities. Some of them are physical, and oftentimes people come because, oh, my leg's not working, or I sprained my hand or my back. And many times that's just a physical manifestation of an emotional situation, right? Some emotional, like withholding or pain or PTSD, whatever it is. And so we're able to work on a lot of different modalities, whether it's somatic coaching, NKT, ART, like a lot, so that they're getting a really holistic avenue for healing. And the other thing we see, it's like when we had the fires up here in Sonoma County, where I live, October 2017, you know, we had those huge fires. We lost like 5,200 houses. It was terrifying. And the firefighters, probably 6 to 8 months later, started having manifestations from that. So they're in it. They're on the line. They're just crushing it. They did an incredible job. And it was horrible for, I mean, it took weeks to get any little bit of containment. And they did the thing. And then there was this lag time. So 6 months later, a year later, then all the different manifestations of holding that stress, right? And we see that it's really common. So for you to say, you know, yeah, I had this, but then 6 months later, it seemed better. But then, yeah, then in another 6 months, there's something else because it still isn't processed. It still isn't cared for in a way that you can move through it.
Yeah, I love that. Love that you shared that. I wanted to talk to you just briefly about mindset. And obviously, we all know that the importance of having a positive mindset. Can you share, though, just any practical tips about how you foster a positive mindset, or how you can kind of help others, especially in that team dynamic, or from a leadership position where you have to have influence over individuals? So,
I have a mantra that my team kind of teases me about, but they also buy in. And it's what if it's all mana? Like, what if it's all resource? What if it's all perfect? And my colleague Laura Grun gave me this bracelet. And she got that engraved on there. And it's a decision that you make that no matter what happens, there is some kind of resource in it. Even if it's tragedy, even if it's not what you wanted, even if it's rejection, whatever it is, that can I position myself to decide that there's resource here so then I can see the resource that is here. And I mean, to me, that I had breast cancer diagnosis in 2022 and I had 6 months of chemotherapy. I'm clean now. Just don't worry if you're listening. But it was, I mean, it's a horrible process. And I learned even deeper through that whether I was getting a biopsy or sitting there getting my chemotherapy or throwing up or whatever it was, I learned to welcome it and to trust it as resource. So I could find resource in it. And that could sound like Pollyanna-ish to people. And I'm certainly not saying it was positive, but just because something isn't what I would label a positive experience doesn't mean that it's not a resourceful experience, that there's not something in it that I can build on or learn from. And I just started asking myself every day, okay, who do I get to be now? Mm. Who do I get to be now in this situation, in this circumstance? Okay, great. Who do I get to be? Who do I get to be? Because that's what I could control. I couldn't control the other stuff. And wanting to and being angry and frustrated and feeling sorry for myself and all that didn't actually help me feel any better physically. And so I decided, okay, I'm gonna play a different game. I'm gonna play this game. Who do I get to be right now? And how can I welcome everything as resource and find the resource in it? And I would say that to me is, it's not necessarily positivity as people typically understand it. It's reality. It's like I'm with reality and I'm also looking at it for a possibility. And I don't have to like the reality. We're not always going to like our reality. And we can't paint everything with a brush. And we can also go, it's like, okay, now it's like I'm in a new gymnasium and I have this weird machine. And now I'm working on a muscle I didn't know I needed to work or I didn't know I had. And that's what sometimes crisis will bring or difficulty will bring. You're building another muscle.
It's so good. I love that you said that. And I don't think it is Pollyanna. I understand, like, yeah, are we just pouring sugar over a pile of crap, right? Like there is some of that, right? But I know Dan Kennedy, who's a famous entrepreneur, leadership coach, he frames it kind of similar to you. And he said, I never lose. He said, because anytime I failure, it's a learning.
Yeah.
And he said, a lot of people don't like that. They think, oh, you can't say that. He goes, I'm always winning though. Always. I feel like I'm winning because failures are just learnings. And he said, you can go on and live your life however you feel like it.
That's right.
But I'm going to go do what I do and it makes me happy. So do what works for you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's so, we get so easily addicted to shame and guilt and seek and destroy missions against our own humanity that it can be a challenge to go, okay, what if there is a learning here? Do I want to know? Do I want to have this learning that's available? Or am I going to shut myself off from the learning because I'm throwing a fit? It's not the way I wanted it to be.
Yeah. And I've always found for myself that anytime I get struck with failure, defeat, I'm a human. So that, I get hurt too, right? I get hurt. I'm not immune to these things. And I just had something like happen to me the other day and I was frustrated and I quickly was like, okay, I'm going to let this go. I'm going to welcome it, surrender, just like you said. And within a minute, I had a new idea. And it just and then by the way, when I did that and unlocked all these, I had such a great answer. I found people that were able to help me. And I just reminded me, like, what if I had just closed off that frequency and just went into guilt, annoyance, frustration, shame? I would have told the unifield out there, the universe, the vibration, the energy, that I'm not accepting new possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. And I got better results. It just reminded me, like, get into action quicker, get out of that state. And it was powerful. So I'm with you.
Yeah. Good for you. That's great.
The last thing I wanted to chat on this specific topic that you brought up is in surrender. And I was talking to an old coach of mine just the other day. We reconnected and I was telling him kind of my story and it's been years. So we're just kind of catching up.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what, Dr. Mark, it's really interesting. I was over there manifesting in the morning at 4 a.m. I was getting up and doing my brain tap and all these things. And I said, nothing worked. Nothing was happening. And I said, I lost a lot of things over the last 2 to 3 years. And when I finally accepted responsibility for how I was showing up and how I was blocking my own frequency and vibration, and I was creating resistance, I essentially gave up. I surrendered. And I said, I've noticed a lot of synchronicities occur for me recently. And like, it's been effortless. And when people talk about manifestation, they say it's effortless. And I go, I'm really starting to feel that for the first time, not trying so hard. And he said, Joel, well, it's really interesting because when he looks at this, he looks at various stages of consciousness. And he said, you were in stage 1 to 2. And he said, manifestation works really well when you're going from like the victim to the victor. But you were already a victor. Now you were trying to go to stage 3. And he said, do you know how you get there? Because you don't get there by manifesting. And I go, how? He said, active surrender.
Yeah, there you go.
And he goes, that's what you did.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, wow, that's really insightful. So
yeah,
I love that you, that's something that you're teaching your leaders, and because it's a really hard thing to do, to actively let go.
Yeah, to let go. And then even in some ways to welcome the thing, right? To go beyond surrender into welcoming is a whole nother level. Like, okay, I welcome it. This is happening somehow for me. Like, let me see how.
Yeah. So good. I know we're getting close to the end of time, and I want to wrap things up and let everybody know where they can find you, connect with you, and if they want to work with you, where that all happens. But before we do, just any exciting projects or anything that you're working on that you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I am in the middle of finishing up a project I started a few years ago with the United Nations, and it's a implementing peace, justice, and security transformation in the country of Somalia. Very ambitious project. And
they have pirates out in Somalia, don't they?
There's so many things.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's what the news says, so I don't know. What do I know?
So I'm not going to Somalia. I'm going to Kenya, and I'm training the facilitators who will be implementing programming on the ground in Somalia. And I am loving working with the Somali people and getting to know them, the men and the women, and understanding things about their culture. It is really complex and really interesting, and noticing that people's draw towards vision and towards possibility, even in situations where, like, this has basically been the same for hundreds and hundreds of years, and now what? And just listening every time I go, I've had 3 trips, and I've got 1 more coming up in May, listening to where are people at between last time and this time, and just hearing things like, I have so much more peace, I'm more confident, I can step into conflict with confidence and navigate community meetings, I'm talking to people about vision and reality and navigation and course correction. And so it's just, I love transformational work, period. I love seeing it in other cultures. I see how everywhere we go, there's humans, and humans are in very similar conversations, right, everywhere. And I think I love that about humanity, just being connected, that we're all really more alike than we are different, and seeing that in different ways is super inspiring to me. And the people there are very inspiring. They're super resilient and beautiful.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing. Well, let's wrap things up and let us know where, if someone wants to connect with you on either social media or your website, and just where can they find you? Where are you living these days, and they, people can connect with you?
Thanks. So yeah, you can find me on Instagram, Jean Marie Jobs. You can look up my corporate training company, Novus Global. Also on Instagram, you could go online, yellowmarker.com, novusglobal.com. And I have a YouTube channel also under Jean Marie Jobs. I've got probably close to 200 videos on all different topics and distinctions.
Yeah, amazing stuff. Jean Marie Jobs, thanks for being on the show. Appreciate you so much.
Thank you so much, Joel. It's been a pleasure.